My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who will guide us to Destination Unlimited. The word guru is used frequently in modern vernacular to imply an expert or a master in a field. We hear about financial gurus, tech gurus, and fashion gurus. The word guru comes from Sanskrit and translates as spiritual teacher and literally a dispeller of darkness. When we think of modern gurus, perhaps Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, Satya Sai Baba, and Swami Satchidananda come to mind, but the first modern superstar guru was Yogananda. 97 years after his arrival in the United States and 65 years after his transition, Paramahansa Yogananda remains the best known and most beloved of all of the Indian spiritual teachers who came to the West. This is because of the durability of his teachings and the institutions he created and inspired, including more than 600 centers worldwide, and his landmark memoir, Autobiography of a Yogi. The book has sold millions of copies since its publication in 1946, but there are huge gaps in the story it tells. Yogananda spent more than 39 of his 59 years in America, yet that period takes up less than 10% of his book. Major events in his life, including challenges, controversies, relationships, formative experiences, are still unknown even to the most ardent of his devotees. My guest this week on Destination Unlimited, Philip Goldberg, has meticulously researched the life of Yogananda to share the rest of his story. Philip grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and now lives in Los Angeles. A professional writer for more than 40 years, he is author and co-author of some 25 books published in more than a dozen languages. He's also a skilled public speaker, workshop leader, spiritual counselor, and the co-host of the popular podcast Spirit Matters. He blogs at Huffington Post and Spirituality and Health and contributes to other publications. His previous book, American Veda, chronicled the impact of India's spiritual teachings on the West and was named one of the top 10 religion books of 2010. His website is philipgoldberg.com, and he joins me this week to discuss his just published book, The Life of Yogananda, the story of the yogi who became the first modern guru. Please welcome to Destination Unlimited, Philip Goldberg. Welcome, Philip.
Great to be with you, Victor. Thanks for the nice introduction.
And thank you for joining us. So when we welcome a new guest to Destination Unlimited, we seek to find out a bit about their own personal path. And here we are, a couple of boys from Brooklyn, talking about Indian spirituality. Please tell us about your life and how it led to your interest in Eastern spirituality.
Well, yes, I was a Brooklyn kid, and I went to college in New York, and was sort of raised in a very secular household, an anti-religious household, so I had no spiritual upbringing whatsoever. And I was a child of the 60s. You know, I was in college during the most chaotic of those years, and was a political activist and protester, and at the same time rather confused and angry and not sure how to go about living life in the world. And I wasn't very pleased with any of the answers I was getting from conventional sources. And so, like a lot of other people in those years, in the youth culture, or the counterculture, as it came to be called, I took drugs, I searched, I explored, and somehow the books about Eastern spiritual teachings, what we think of as Hinduism and Buddhism, but are really just sort of the esoteric or mystical teachings of all the world's traditions, but the sort of philosophy behind yoga and in the largest sense of the word, yoga, came to my awareness, and I just resonated with those. It became an obsession of mine, really, more important than my schoolwork at the time, to read everything I could get my hands on. One of those sources was Yogananda's Autobiography of a Yogi. And through all that, I sort of came to set foot on a spiritual path that was centered on meditation practice. And I became one of the early transcendental meditation teachers. You mentioned Maharishi Mahesh Yogi before. He was my teacher back then. And that became the sort of centerpiece of my life as I moved forward, trying to integrate my spiritual passions and priorities with what we call real life. And in the last several years, I came to write about all that in American Veda and now in the life of Yogananda.
And did you find any challenges when you were on this path, that people telling you that you shouldn't pursue that path, or people who were challenging what you were doing?
Oh, sure. In those days, you know, late 60s, early 70s, it was long before, you know, health providers started recommending meditation for stress relief, and meditation and yoga became a standard part of therapeutic practices in psychology and medicine. So back then, especially if you did more than just meditate a couple of times a day secretly, but if you were going off on retreats and training to be a teacher of these methods, then it you stood out, and family and friends were understandably concerned that you might be getting involved with a dangerous cult or just sort of going off the loose end somewhere. On the other hand, they saw my life improve and getting better in all kinds of ways, including, you know, the stopping of bad habits like taking drugs. And so people kind of were ambivalent, but eventually came around to recognizing that this was something good for me, and in many cases realized maybe they should look into it themselves. So that's how these the acceptance of these methods and the mainstreaming of meditation and yoga came about back, you know, in the 70s.
You know, I think it's important to look at that. It's teaching by example. When we change our lives in a positive direction, the wonderful and positive influence it has on those around us.
Absolutely. And they can see it. Look, you know, I was young. My father was very concerned about, my mother had already passed, but my father and some of, you know, the older relatives were very concerned about how this bright young guy was going astray. and you know, when they saw my life change, and I said I could attribute it a lot to not just ordinary maturity, but my meditation practice, well, the people's eyes open from that, and they come to change their minds. So, and you know, getting back to my new book, you know, that you could see that in Yogananda's life back in even the 20s and 30s. And then in by my era, the late 60s and 70s, when a whole parade of gurus came around and things caught on, you saw, as chronicled in American Veda, you saw a transition from passionate interest in Indian teachings among hippies and counterculture people and rock musicians. Within 6 or 7 years, it became part of the mainstream. And the reason for that was grown-ups who saw changes in young people wondered why these practices would have such a good effect. Is it all an illusion? Is it a placebo? What's going on? So they did studies. I was, in fact, you know, just coincidentally, a subject in one of the early studies on meditation, because I just happened to volunteer. And And those studies, when they got published in mainstream medical journals and magazines like Scientific American, they had a big impact on the mainstream. So the phenomenon went from hippies meditating and getting off LSD to their parents getting off of Valium.
Absolutely. For those of our listeners who want to get into a practice of meditation and say, I just can't do it, what do you say to people like that?
I say frequently that people who say they can't meditate have never actually been instructed properly. They pick something up in a magazine or a book and they hear, oh, you have to quiet your mind. Well, that's doesn't constitute instruction. It would be like watching people drive and then getting behind the wheel without ever taking a lesson or something. There are reputable places to learn reputable and reliable meditation practices, and people should take those courses and be willing to, you know, pay the fee or whatever it is, because otherwise the benefits won't come.
And what are those benefits for those who have never experienced them?
Calmness, calmer mind, deeper relaxation, clearer mind. The list goes on. There are hundreds and hundreds of studies, but it amounts to more inner peace, clearer mind, and less, more resilience in the face of stress.
And that also leads to better physical conditioning, because you take away the stress, and the stress is no longer applied upon the body.
Yes, and there are a lot of studies showing the direct effects of meditation practices on conditions like high blood pressure, heart disease, and all kinds of maladies. As you said, the body tends to heal itself when it's under less stress and when there's some inner calm.
My guest is Philip Goldberg. He's the author of The Life of Yogananda, the story of the yogi who became the first modern guru. We'll be back with more of Philip and the story of Yogananda after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Tune in to The Practical Intuitive, Mind, Body, Spirit for the Real World, with me, host Robin Fritz, Mondays at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 Eastern. I'll cover personal and business intuition, animal communication, mediumship, space clearing, past life regression, shamanic insights, energy healing, soul choice, and more, all to help you tap your own intuitive and healing skills. No ifs, ands, or buts.
My name is Meera Batra, and this is How I Live United. Many families have come to America for a better life. I advocate for these families with United Way. United Way empowers them to see opportunities available. We help them get involved with their kids, schools, and network within the community. My name is Meera Batra. I help families see opportunity and succeed. I don't just wear the shirt, I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live united. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
180 over 111, and I had a stroke.
I couldn't speak or walk.
This is high blood pressure. Get back on your plan. Go to loweryourhbp.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association, American Medical Association, and the Ad Council.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this evening is Philip Goldberg. He's the author of The Life of Yogananda, the story of the yogi who became the first modern guru. Philip, I think it's important before discussing your biography of Yogananda to clarify some of the vocabulary of Eastern spirituality. I started your introduction by talking about the word guru. What's your definition of guru?
Well, you defined it well, but I stick with the vernacular. As you said, the word has caught on. It's one of those Sanskrit words like mantra and karma that have become mainstream, and it tends to mean a teacher of any kind. But in its original meaning, it stands for a spiritual teacher, and there are different kinds of spiritual teachers. There's the upa-gurus, the people from whom you learn anything, and then there's the sadguru, who is the principal guru in a person's life, who they have a certain level of loyalty to, ranging from, well, that's my teacher, he's my spiritual mentor, or she's my spiritual guide, to a serious commitment of a disciple and master that is for only the rare people who can make that kind of commitment. But it essentially means a spiritual expert on whom one relies for guidance and leadership.
I'm not in any means a scholar in Sanskrit, but I love the way that the roots of the words come together to produce these beautiful word pictures. Gu meaning dispeller, and Ru is darkness, dispeller of darkness. What a beautiful concept.
It is, and that's, you know, the highest sense of a guru. He will help you remove from your consciousness the impediments to enlightenment or self-realization, the levels of ignorance and illusion that stand in the way of us realizing our highest potential and true nature.
Now, when we hear the word yoga in the West, many of us think of hatha yoga and the various poses and breathing techniques that are used. What does yoga actually mean, and are there different types of yoga?
Well, speaking of Sanskrit, it stems from the same root that gives us the word yoke. So yoga means essentially union or to unite. And in its highest sense, it means the unification of the individual person, self, what we think of as, you know, Victor or Phil, the consciousness in this body, the individual, with the what might be called universal consciousness or spirit. Some people use the term God. In Sanskrit, it would be called Brahman. The ultimate reality of existence, which is in spiritual traditions, is considered sacred and divine, and in secular terms might just be thought of as a universal consciousness the unifying force or field that permeates everything. So it's an awakening to a higher definition of the self that's usually hidden as we go about our lives, identifying with the individual personality, and we sort of are not aware of the deeper and higher identity of the self, that realization of which brings with it a certain level of peace and expanded awareness and inner contentment.
Now, I had mentioned hatha yoga. What are the other types of yoga?
Well, traditionally, there are different pathways of yoga, but yoga means... It's an interesting thing, because yoga it can be thought of as a set of practices or methods that bring you to the state of yoga. And the state of yoga is this union or of the sense of oneness that I already described. And the means of getting there are different types of yoga. Raja yoga, which is generally thought of as a path where the centerpiece is meditation methods. There is karma yoga, which is a path of action in the world done selflessly and without attachment to the results. There's bhakti yoga, which is a yoga of devotion. So when you see people chanting Sanskrit mantras, or you go to a church and people are singing hymns, or to a synagogue and they're doing the same with Hebrew, those are forms, you could say, of bhakti yoga, even though people won't use those terms. And so there are those methods, and there's something called Gyan Yoga, which is essentially a yoga of the mind where study and discernment are involved. So there's different pathways of yoga. Hatha Yoga is the one that emphasizes the physical practices that have come to be synonymous with yoga because of their trendiness and fashionability. But those postures and positions, which have tremendous health benefits, were originally meant to sort of stabilize and purify the body, the nervous system, to make it more conducive to the meditation practices. So it was sort of part of a yogi's repertoire of practices leading to the state of union.
Now, you mentioned karma yoga. Karma is a word that's often used but misunderstood. What is karma, and also how is that related to kriya?
Well, they both come from the same root, a Sanskrit root that gives us essentially meaning action. So kriya is an action. Kriya yoga would be actions that bring about the state of yoga. So they can include all the things we talked about before, meditation, yoga asanas and postures, breathing practices, and so forth. And karma means action. But the larger implication of karma is of a sort of principle of how the universe works. And we think of it in the West, you know, there's a biblical expression that you reap what you sow. And karma is essentially an embodiment of that aphorism, that everything you do, every thought, every action, every intention has consequences. And in a certain, you know, to use a metaphor, it's like dropping a petal in a pond and then it reverberates, sending ripples out into the environment, but it will come back. It comes back to you in some form or another. And it's, as you said, often misunderstood in to sort of imply a kind of fatalism or, you know, an exoneration of responsibility because, well, it's just their karma or, you know. But in fact, it's a call to action and to responsible action and action in the service of goodness and generosity of spirit. People who understand karma or accept that the universe has a certain system of justice in it know that bad actions will somehow and someday, some way, come back to you, and good actions will come back in a positive way.
Now, when we think of the names of many of the famous gurus, Ananda is often part of their names, Yogananda, Satchidananda, etc. What is Ananda?
Ananda means bliss. And so in the Indian spiritual traditions, somehow it's an aspiration because that... It means bliss in a sense that's more than sort of just I feel good or I'm happy or at momentarily feeling elated. It's a deep inner contentment and, you know, sense of joy that accompanies the spiritual development we associate with the state of enlightenment or yoga, the inner being, the inner state of calmness and perfect peace and silence that yoga brings about is accompanied by a sense of bliss in certain, you know, in varying degrees, of course, but because that is said to be our true nature. And so people who take vows as swamis and are initiated into lineages, typically they have names that end in Ananda because, and then the first part will be something either that the guru, whoever gives them the name, think is part of their character or is the main path to that state of bliss.
And
so Yogananda,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yogananda took his own name to mean taking the path of yoga to bliss.
And what about Paramahansa?
That's a sort of honorific, a sort of name, a term given to people who are considered to be of high spiritual status in India. And it's not some official thing like becoming a cardinal or a bishop. It's more informal, and it's either, you know, the public or, you know, comes to call the person that, or the person's guru bestows it upon the person. But essentially, it has to do with swans, the animal swan, the bird, is said to have great discernment, and not to mention, you know, beauty and certain perfections. So it's come to be a symbol of high attainment.
My guest this week on Destination Unlimited is Philip Goldberg. He's the author of The Life of Yogananda, the story of the yogi who became the first modern guru. Philip, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you and your work.
They can get the book wherever books are sold, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, brick and mortar places, online places, all the usual suspects. And I would appreciate it if they like it, they leave a review online. And my website is philipgoldberg.com, Philip with one L, Goldberg as in Whoopi, .com.
And we'll be back with more of Phil Goldberg and the life of Yogananda after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
This is OTRFM, part of the iOM Radio Network.
Change and growth are part of natural life, and also part of your spiritual life. Everyone needs support and guidance, especially during life passages. Upgrade yourself with the OM Times Experts program. With OM Times Experts, you have access to the best intuitive coaches, spiritual teachers, counselors, astrologists, and oracles. Our team was carefully selected so you can trust. Find out more at experts.omtimes.com.
Grab a cup of tea or a glass of wine and tune in for Inspired Conversations with publisher Linda Joy on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Linda creates sacred space for leading female luminaries, empowering authors, heart-centered female entrepreneurs, coaches, and healers. A soulful venue where guests openly share the fears and obstacles they've overcome, wisdom and lessons learned, and the personal journey that led them to the transformational work they do in the world. Inspired Conversations to empower you on your path to authentic, soulful living.
Steven.
Who said that?
Me, down here.
Ugh, what are you, a yellow booger?
I'm a banana slug, Steven.
What are you doing in my room?
I'm your sense of adventure. It's been a long time since we've had an adventure in the forest.
Mom took me to the forest last year.
I'm a slug, Steven. It took me a long time to get here.
You're right. I should get out.
Yeah, the forest is not that far away.
Hey, Mom!
Come to the forest where the more adventurous you lives. Check out discovertheforest.org for cool places nearby. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Bill Maher. I can find humor in almost anything, but one thing I never laugh about is cruelty to animals. If you don't get the joke either, write People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, 501 Front Street, Norfolk, Virginia, 23510.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week is Philip Goldberg. He's the author of The Life of Yogananda, the story of the yogi who became the first modern guru. And Phil, before the break, we were talking about some definitions of words, and I have two more to discuss. The words guru and baba, which could be father, grandfather, or wise man, are often appended with G. What is G?
It's kind of, if you go to India, and people who respect you, they'll say Victor G. Mm. So it's like, you know, in Japan, it's san. So, you know, it's like Mr. or Sir, you could say, and or ma'am. And it's just something appended to a name as a sign of respect. And so gurus often have that. So disciples or devotees will say Guruji. or if it's if the term Baba is used, they'll say Babaji, Amaji for a female guru, that sort of thing.
Absolutely. And finally,
I'm called Philji.
Philji, there you go. I like that. Philji, right. That's great.
Yeah.
And finally, what is Darshan?
Darshan essentially means being in the presence of or absorb, taking in the light of, and it's in the vernacular, it's when people come to either a teacher or a spiritual person who's thought to be in a higher state of a spiritual attainment, or all some, it could even mean in the presence of an icon or an object of worship in a temple or something. But it means to, and you know, there's a certain vibratory quality that emanates that brings about, you know, a sort of inner sense of peace and sometimes bliss or ecstasy.
Often when we see portraits or photos of great spiritual teachers, we see them surrounded by a golden type of glow, the aura per se. Why do you think that's attributed to those folks?
You know, I think we all have subtle emanations that are hard to perceive, but that are felt in the environment, having to do with the nature of our thoughts, the quality of our nervous system. So if you're tense or angry or tired or disturbed, that might have an effect on the environment, just like a discordant note from a musical instrument might, only we don't hear it, but it could be felt. And similarly, if we're in a higher state of awareness or perfectly at peace, you know, we emanate that. And we've all felt the difference walking in a room where there's an argument going on or a room where people are praying or meditating. We feel the difference. So something emanates from us. And I think those portrayals are meant to depict that, you know, light and spirit emanate from certain people.
And for those who have the ability to see or sense subtle energy,
yeah,
that's something that's very common.
Right. It could be very tangible to them. And I think that's probably where it came from people who had those higher levels of perception, seeing that. And so the tradition of painting halos or, you know, emanating light and so forth from spiritual beings came to be.
Now, in your new book, The Life of Yogananda, you share that his parents named him Mukunda and that he was at a minimum precocious. What made him different than other children?
You know, it's fascinating. You know, some nature of you know, we always argue about nature and nurture. And in Yogananda's case, when I tracked his life, and it's an extraordinary life, you see the effects of his environment, but you also see that he just had his own nature from the earliest days. He was spiritually precocious. He knew that his destiny was to be a dedicated spiritual person. He tried to run away to the Himalayas to be a monk and find a guru when he was 11 years old. And he tried a few more times, but was tracked down by his family and brought back. And he just knew that. And no matter what the family did to sort of try to get him to live a more conventional life, they arranged marriages for him when he was a teenager. You know, his father, he set him up with a great job when he finished college. You know, he didn't want any of it. He just was determined, and he knew from early childhood that the spiritual life was to be his, and that the life of renunciation of a monk was to be his. He did finish college because his guru and his family sort of insisted on it. That was his one concession. But there was, but for the most part, you know, he just was a determined spiritual seeker. And it was fascinating for me to learn about his teenage years. You know, we all remember when we were adolescents and teenagers that there were always natural leaders, you know, people who were sort of instigators and organizers. And you know, in our lives, they were the people who, you know, put on a party or, you know, got a group together to, you know, start a game or a team or, you know, or make some mischief or something. But in Yogananda's case, he was organizing spiritual gatherings, you know, what are called satsangs. And he created a little ashram when he was 15. So the destiny was written on him. But of course, you know, when you're that independent-minded and that unconventional, even though in India, you know, being a spiritual seeker is a mark of status, at that age, you know, you find resistance. And of course, he didn't care very much for school. He ignored it. So he had this independent spirit and a bit of rebelliousness in him. But eventually, when he came to meet his guru, you know, he learned discipline and settled down. But that combination of independent spirit and unconventionality and loyalty to tradition and his lineage and his family, that same kind of combination of factors. You see it in his childhood, and you see it in his youth, and you see it as a mature spiritual teacher and leader.
Was there a sense or indication that he may have been the reincarnation of a previous guru or teacher?
There's always that kind of speculation. And he sometimes would talk in those terms, but I don't how one verifies such things. And so I'm agnostic. Nope. but if you think of, you know, the sort of standard way that in India or in Hinduism they would think of such things, it's illogical. If you accept the premise of reincarnation and all that, it would be a logical thing to conclude that he was a, you know, guru in the past or leader of some kind in the past.
Now, what gurus and Indian saints influenced young Mukunda and his family?
It turns out his parents were disciples of a well-known householder guru, not a renunciate, named Lahiri Mahasya, who in turn had a legendary guru known as Babaji, who is said to be timeless and ageless and makes rare appearances in the Himalayas. And Lahiri Mahasya was in what was then called Benares, and was to revive a certain tradition of teachings that Yogananda made known as Kriya Yoga. And he had a disciple named Sri Yukteswar, and Sri Yukteswar became Yogananda's guru. He met him after he finished college and became a disciple, and Sri Yukteswar initiated him into that lineage, made him a swami, and then he was given essentially, or was destined to have, the mission of bringing India's spiritual treasures in the form of his particular lineage's methods to the West. And that's what he did.
Now, you mentioned the difference between renunciates and householders. How important was that differentiation in young Mukunda's life?
Oh, it's critical in any spiritual person's life in India. You know, there's the renunciate way. There's a you know, ancient tradition of people, you know, renouncing the world to dedicate themselves to spiritual pursuits. I mean, even, you know, you could think of Buddha as one of them. And, you know, if you go to India, you see men, and mostly men, in our orange robes, living the life of renunciates, either independently or in the context of an ashram or a monastery. And there are different teachings and different methods for those monks and nuns than the overwhelming majority of human beings who are householders and, you know, inclined toward worldly responsibilities, family life, parenting, and so forth. So, you know, there are different paths, different methods leading to the same goal.
And how did that affect his life?
He wanted to be a renunciate. He just knew that was his destiny. But of course, his family was urging him toward the life of a householder. But eventually they came around and realized that there was no fighting this. It was his, what he was meant to be, and it was where his happiness and fortune, not fortune, but his destiny lie. And there was never any question in his mind. But, you know, that meant he was to take those vows and live that life.
My guest is Philip Goldberg. He's the author of The Life of Yogananda, the story of the yogi who became the first modern guru. We'll be back with more, Phil, after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Hi, I'm Kelly Fox, host and astrologer of The Astrology Show. Each week, I'll give you access to the current transits, which are a valuable tool that provide astrological information to help unlock the potential each of us has. Understanding the stars can help steer us in the right direction to make better informed choices. So if you're wondering what's going to happen in your week ahead, be sure to tune in to The Astrology Show for guidance, Mondays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time.
Some knowledge belongs to us and us alone. The way our girlfriends walk, talk, touch their hair. Details that only a sister can know about her girls. But what about our other girls? The ones we carry with us every day. Our bond with our sister girls gives life. But knowing your breasts can save it. Go to knowyourgirls.org for the facts you need on breast health. Brought to you by Susan G. Komen and the Ad Council.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week is Philip Goldberg. He's the author of The Life of Yogananda, the story of the yogi who became the first modern guru. Phil, what other special qualities did Mukunda display in his youth? Were there any miracles that were attributed to him?
Yeah, depending on how, you know, what your criteria are for miracles. There were miracles and wonders and what we think of as psychic powers. Throughout Yogananda's life, he was, if you read his iconic autobiography of a yogi, you know, it's filled with, you know, stories about these accomplished yoga masters doing things that we would consider miraculous. About which there's, you know, tremendous amount of stories and explanation in the yogic literature. And it is said that he had powers of mind, even partly sort of innate and some cultivated, because from an early age he was exploring methods of from the yoga tradition of mind control and mind power. So he was able to do things like stop his breathing, and there were instances of incredible insight into what other people were thinking, moments of what we might ordinarily might think of as coincidence, but were could be attributed to a subtle, you know, very high form of intuition. And there were stories of him that he relates about these really accomplished yogis doing, you know, everything from levitating to appearing in two places at once. I mean, these kind of the real miraculous stuff that make people shake their heads and say that's impossible, he made that up, or he's you know, just being gullible, to the kind of things that even average people would say, oh yeah, I get those psychic experiences sometimes, you know, deep intuitions, things that appear to be coincidence that are, you know, we think of as synchronous experiences and so forth. And there was a lot of that in his life. But, you know, and people who may be listening and have read Yogananda's books, they will know that he's been accused of being overly enamored with, you know, miracles and powers. But it's very common for teachers in India to use those to get your attention and to say, look, this is what the mind can do. But doing those things is not the purpose of life. It's not the purpose of spirituality or of yoga. These are just sort of fringe benefits to be paid much attention to. And he was an advocate of that. He would talk about those things, explain them, even admit that they had some utility, but then warn people not to try to cultivate them, not to become enamored of them, because the true purpose of spirituality is inner peace and the development of qualities like higher consciousness and compassion and love and the real things that make life worthwhile and fulfilling. Whereas the other things, the miracles and wonders, could be distractions.
You know, I agree with you, and it's interesting how modern quantum physics is beginning to start giving the possible groundwork for these things to be true and
absolutely
and to be and scientifically explained. And I said my show is about the crossroads between science and spirituality, and one of these mm-hmm. days I think this is all going to become very open to all of us.
Oh, well, absolutely. Yeah. If you've been looking at this stuff over the course of decades like you and I have, you see more and more of that convergence. But now you go back in Yogananda's life, or even his great predecessor, Swami Vivekananda in the 1890s, who was a friend of Tesla's. Mm-hmm. And they were comparing notes from the, you know, Indian spiritual tradition and the scientific tradition. And then in Yogananda's world in the 20s and 30s, his very first talk in America in 1920, when he first came here, was called The Science of Religion. So in the Indian spiritual traditions, in the yogic world, there's never been a conflict between science and yoga. It's always been said to be compatible, and yoga is understood to be a kind of science of mind or a science of consciousness. And so Yogananda was preferring explanations for certain phenomena according to what was then known in the 20s and 30s by science. And by now, almost a century later, my God, we know so much more.
Absolutely. You share in your book about his closeness with his mother. How did his mother's passing affect him?
It was really moving to write about that. You know, a lot of people who take renunciate vows and become monks, they don't speak much about their personal lives or their lives before they became. But Yogananda did, and others, like his brother, wrote about it as well. And it was deeply moving. He was only 11 years old. He was very close to his mother. From all indications, she was a very noble and deeply spiritual and loving human being. And it was a devastating loss. He acknowledged that, and it's one of the reasons he ran away to the Himalayas to become a monk not long after that, the first attempt to run away after that. But he also says that that loss, the loss of the feminine presence of love and nurturing and the embrace of mother led him to more fully embrace himself, the feminine form of God, what in India might be called, he used to refer to as divine mother.
Mm-hmm.
So in the Indian spiritual tradition, God is not just a male persona. God is male and female and neither. So there are masculine expressions of deity and female expressions of deity, and sort of on equal footing, and people have their preferences, or there are times when one turns to one or the other. And he had a strong connection to, and many worshipful practices centered on Divine Mother, and he always said that that was reinforced or, you know, came about largely because of the loss of his earthly mother. He wrote wonderful poems about his mother and divine mother.
What brought him to America?
Well, that's interesting because in his guru tradition, his guru was told by his guru that he would have a disciple who was destined to bring these teachings to America or to the West. And Sri Yukteswar, his guru, recognized in young Yogananda, before he was even Yogananda, that he was the one. And there was this sense of destiny about it, even in his childhood, that people were told. And so after he became a Swami and established a school with some of his fellow Swamis in India, sort of spiritual curriculum / educational institution, he one day in meditation had this deep experience that it was time to go to America. And I loved writing about this in the book because what followed, he didn't know where he was going or when or how or for what purpose, but he just knew the time had come. And then a series of events happened that ended up with him on a ship, not coincidentally, but interestingly, the first passenger ship to go from India to America since before World War I. All the shippings had been suspended for the war. So this was 1920, and part of the series of events that occurred that got him on that boat was he was to substitute for a designated representative from India at an international congress of religious teachers in Boston, sponsored by the Unitarians. And so he, at age 27, was essentially come to speak about the Hindu tradition in Boston. And he arrived in September of 1920 and had told his father he'd be back in 3 months unless the Americans needed him. And he ended up, you know, 3 decades, not 3 months, with only one return visit to India in those 32 years. Very moving. And I love, you know, writing about how he had to adapt to a life in America in 1920 and then, you know, carry on his mission through the Great Depression and the war years. One of the things that, you know, you discover is that even these great spiritual teachers, they, if they have a worldly mission, they struggle, they have challenges, they have to pay the bills, they have to deal with foolish human beings and lawsuits and all kinds of stuff. And he struggled a lot more than people realize. And I came to respect him even more for persevering and overcoming.
And your book wonderfully details a lot of those experiences. What's his legacy?
Oh, it's tremendous. In American Veda, I talk about the impact of India's spiritual teachings on the West, and I talk about all the people who are mainly responsible for that transmission of teachings. And in that, you know, constellation of great teachers and thinkers, he stands out as maybe the most important, or certainly one of the two or three most important, because of the autobiography of a yogi and the teachings he left behind, the methods he teaches, the institutions he started and are maintained. His impact is tremendous and still is, even after all these years.
My guest, Phil Goldberg, the author of The Life of Yogananda, the story of the yogi who became the first modern guru. Phil, I understand you're going to be at the Open Center here in New York on June 8th.
I will be at, that's right, I'll be at the Open Center in New York on June 8th. And next week, the week prior to that, I'll be in the Boston area. And people can see my schedule of appearances and learn about the tours I lead in India. We have one coming up in September, and there are still some vacancies on my website, philipgoldberg.com. Yes, and if you're in the New York area, please come to the Open Center, June 8th.
Absolutely. Phil, thank you so much for joining us this evening and sharing this wonderful story of Yogananda.
Thank you, Victor. I hope your readers read the book, and I want to just let them know that it's not just a great story, but they will learn a lot that will enhance their own lives and their own spiritual paths from his example.
Very inspirational. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for joining us on Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor, the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful week.